Good morning. So, way back a week ago, we talked about sockets. We finished up talking about sockets, and we were talking about, you know, that we can use sockets to do broadcast or multicast. So this doesn't make sense for TCP, but for UDP, we can send a datagram instead of just to one place. We can send it to multiple places at once. And kind of the way that works is that either we send it to this special all ones broadcast address, in which case everyone can receive it on that port number if they're on the local network, or we can send it to these special multicast addresses that you kind of have to subscribe to. And we looked at multicast addresses that just work in the local networks. I alluded to it being possible to do multicast between different networks, but we haven't discussed how that works, and I'm not planning on it, but you know, there's lots of interest. That's a real big networking topic out there. And we looked at one application of this, which was multicast DNS, which is kind of most notably used for service discovery. So like if you can pull up on your phone and like connect to the, you know, things on your local network and without like specifying their addresses or anything, that's probably how that works. We also briefly mentioned there are other address families that aren't the internet ones, and like the two most notable were this Unix address family, so we can use the same interface for very local communication without using the localhost IP address, but we can also do that. And this RAW, which is usually how programs like Wireshark work, and also lets you send packets in that sense. Then we started talking about HTTP. So we go through the basic message format and what URLs were and how they corresponded to that. And we basically have these headers, these kind of key value pairs, and some special extra fields that, you know, in HTTP 2 and 3, they put back in the headers because they realize it's kind of silly to have a separate status and path and such from that. And accompanying that is this body of each message that is not always there. So for like most requests, it's not there because, you know, when we're getting a document, we don't have a big piece of data to send, but when we're receiving a document, we certainly do. So we have these request and response bodies that are just arbitrary data. And we mentioned, you know, that, you know, we can just send them all at once. And we also have this way of kind of sending them in sort of chunks if we don't know their length in advance. But we still want to support persistent connections, this idea that we should be able to open one TCP connection and make a whole bunch of HTTP requests on it. This is pretty important for efficiency because, well, we learned opening a TCP connection involves this sort of back and forth where we don't send any data. So if we have like a web page with like 50 images on it, it's going to be pretty bad if we don't use persistent connections. We're just going to add a lot of time to load that, even if all those images are teeny. And we mentioned kind of an alternative idea for this, you know, sorry, an extension of this, which was pipelining, which is that we can actually try to send multiple requests before we receive a response. And that should be fine. And I say should be fine, so something I didn't mention. If you look up what web browsers actually do for pipelining, a bunch of them implemented it and turned it off. Because an unfortunate thing about working on the internet is that people don't implement protocols correctly. Which I guess you probably will discover if you test your HTTP servers that some of you are starting writing for pipelining, you'll probably discover, oops, didn't actually implement that correctly. But it's supposed to work, but they turn it off because there's some servers that it's broken in and they just misbehave. Then we mentioned kind of the actual kind of next step of this, which was HTTP 2 and 3. And kind of the big thing HTTP 2 added was this multiplexing, that rather than having a sequence of requests, we let you have one TCP connection that kind of has multiple sub-connections within it, and we can interleave them. So if we're receiving, you know, 50 images for a web page, we can make requests for all 50 of them, and we can get back in this one TCP connection those images in whatever order the server can get them in fastest. And then we talked about HTTP 3 briefly, which, you know, the main difference with between HTTP 2 and HTTP 3 is HTTP 3 gets rid of TCP and uses this kind of newer transport protocol called QUIC. That is hopefully better for web stuff than TCP. Interesting question of whether it is, but like one of the big things it does is like it doesn't have a handshake where you can't send data. It lets browsers send data and servers send data during the handshake process if they want. And also kind of integrates TLS, so encryption in that process to make that more efficient. And because it's UDP based, if we're multiplexing, we don't have to, if the server sends back document A, then document B, and the packets for document A get lost, since it's UDP, we'll still get the ones for B and be able to use them immediately, which wouldn't happen for TCP, where the OS would keep those from us while it's waiting to get the ones for A reset. And we also mentioned some other features of HTTP. So we mentioned content negotiation, so this idea that the URL isn't the whole story about what document we're getting, that we can sort of specify what document with these headers, and maybe this idea didn't work out as well as we might like, because it's kind of advised against, because it doesn't work well with, for one thing, caching. And caching, we have this idea that, well, we can mark all these documents, we have these headers, and one of the things we'll use them for is to indicate to browsers, and as we'll learn today, proxies, whether they can cache those documents and not make requests in the future, or if they do make requests, we'll let them make requests saying, hey, I have this older version of this document, is that still okay? So we saw these conditional gets, where we can, not have to set a firm amount of time which this is valid, so we can update, say, our web page at any time, but still get a lot of the advantages of caching, in spite of that, because we won't resend it if it doesn't change. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so based on the quiz results, I should go over option C, D, and E of question one. So in question one, we had this code that used a UDP socket. You could tell it was a UDP socket because we used socdgram. So it can't be TCP. And it called bind. So one of the question C was how many packets are sent? So when we call bind, that just kind of sets the address locally. We don't need to communicate with the network to do that. So that's no packets. When we call send to, that sends a UDP packet. We don't need to send extra packets to make that happen. And when we call receive from, some other machine sent us a packet for that to return. So we only really send one packet here, one IP packet. Now, you might be thinking, but aren't you like doing ARP and such? I agree. We're probably doing that sort of thing. Those aren't IP packets. Those are other types of packets. So that's the number of packets. So then there was a question about, do we know that the host returned by receive from was 11.12.13.14? And the reason why 11.12.13.14 was a good candidate is that we were sending to 11.12.13.14. So it's not unlikely that we're getting a reply from that address. But with UDP sockets that aren't connected, like these weren't, we can get packets from anywhere. Anyone can send them to us. So there's no guarantee, and if other people are sending to port 12345, we will get different packets from receive from, different datagrams. So host could be some other address. And I think E was, there was no other sockets for this address, because we know that like the system doesn't let, unless you set some special, do some special work, doesn't let you like have multiple servers all bound to the same address, unless you do something special, to the same But the issue is that like what we're looking for is this 5-tuple, right? So the 5-tuple we specified in this assignment is this one. So we can have other ones of tuples like that that don't conflict. So yes, we can't have UDP this IP address 10.11.12.13 and port 12345. But if one of these things changes, one of these two things changes, it doesn't conflict. So for example, we can have a TCP server running in a different program on the same port. It's distinct as far as our operating system is concerned. We can have a UDP server running on the same port with a different IP address. It's distinct as far as the operating system is concerned. When it gets a packet coming in, it looks at the destination IP and says, oh, that doesn't conflict. And you know, even if we only have one internet connection, we probably have two IP addresses, the one for the internet connection and this internal localhost one that doesn't work on a network but works on a local machine. And if we have multiple connections or one connection with multiple IPs, we can do that. We can have multiple addresses that are internet accessible. Okay, so questions? Okay, and I'll briefly mention the assignment that's due next week to make an HTTP server. The big thing I think that, so this assignment is very similar to what has been in prior versions of the courses, the first assignment. The big change I've made, which I do think makes the assignment a little trickier, is you have to handle persistent connections. Because without that, you just close after the request and then you don't need to worry about figuring out how long the request is. And you also don't need to worry about indicating how long the response is. So that's the big difference, but I'm hoping it's not super tricky. I think the trickiest things to realize are, as mentioned in the assignment, that when you read from the network, you could read parts of multiple requests, or you could read something and it won't be a full request. You need to handle both of those cases. Okay, and last time we talked about cookies. So let's do a little exercise with cookies here. So here I have a web server, here's my logs for my web server. And whether when I did set cookie and cookie, my question is let's estimate how many unique users we have in these requests. So the maximum is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, right? To work that out and pull for answers. You can check with your neighbors if you agree to. Would like more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, so who thinks we have, let's say, two users, three, four, a few for four, five, a few for couple, one for five, six, for six, seven or more? So we have four, five, six seems to be our range. Any other? Yes. And I think there are multiple, reasonable guesses here because of what's happening. Let's go through the cases where we can tie requests together and say almost certainly these are the same browser, at least, the same client. And we can do that by assuming that we set cookie to unique values each time, which, well, isn't actually guaranteed, but, if we want to do this sort of analysis, that's something we should do. Then it would seem that these requests here are all from the same client, and that these requests here are all from the same client. And that we can be pretty certain that this request here is not from the client with the session ID 1234 because it sent it before and after, so surely didn't forget about that. And the same for this request. And we can, guess that this 3456 is probably not one of these, but maybe it is. So I would say our high estimate then is that we have 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, so my estimate is, I would estimate we have four users based on this analysis. So you see I have the 1, 2, 3, 4 user. So this is user 1, 1, 1. I have the user who sent this request here, 2. I have the user 2, 3, 4, 5 user, which is these three requests. And I have the 3456 user. 3456 user. So I would get say 4 is sort of our high, is what I would say is the high estimate. And it could be lower if it turns out that actually user 2 and user 4 are the same person, but they just their cookies just didn't persist between them, maybe because their web browser doesn't store cookies or because they cleared the cookies in some way or something like that, or they just expired, they ran out, went too long, or they closed the browser and the browser erased cookies then, that sort of thing. So I would say 4 is the high estimate, and 3 would be kind of our low estimate. Questions about that? And then we have IPs per user. And if I look at my analysis here, if I look at the IP addresses, user 1 looks like they're always the same IP. We have user 2 and 4 also on that IP the whole time. And user 3 on that IP. So apparently this one IP is shared between 3 or 4 users at some point in time. And also it looks like that we had one user here, user 3, moved to different IP addresses. But assuming we only set cookies, send the same SID one time, then that must be the same client. And that must be the same client. Us being able to make that conclusion is one reason why people are concerned about this in tracking, right, is that we learned kind of incidentally that the user probably physically moved around. questions about cookie tracking exercise. And so this also shows why like browsers have a lot of concern about cookies and third-party cookies. And one thing which has come up is that this kind of tracking happens kind of by accident in other ways. And so one example is with caches. So we mentioned that you do, you know, the way caches work is that we can do store something and do a conditional GET request. And one way that that works is we can have this E tag for entity tag header, and we can do an if done match request with that entity tag value, and if it doesn't match, the server will send us back. You know, if it does match, the server will just say, nope, you have the right version, otherwise it will actually send us the new version. But a problem here is that, you know, the browser is storing that and resending it every time it requests this document. It's basically a cookie for as long as it stays cached. And this kind of idea, this being one application of it, you know, is sometimes referred to as super cookies because they're like cookies, but they don't like obey the clear cookies button in your browser. And there's other mechanisms that achieve a similar effect. So for example, you might say, well, the E tag, of course, like it has this weird data, let's not use that. Well, we can do the same trick with last modified. You can choose unique last modified times for everyone, or different last modified times for different files, or that sort of thing. Yeah. What are the third-party cookie rules? So the third-party cookie rules are that some browsers enforce is that if I go to foo.com and foo.com has an image, say, from bar.com displayed in it, that bar.com gets a different set of cookies than if I went to bar.com directly or if I went to, you know, quex.com and loaded the image. Right, that these should all be, that we should have separate cookies for these two connections so bar.com can't figure out I went to foo and quex. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Right, so that's one of the things that some browsers do to prevent tracking is that they separate the cookies out or they have other restrictions on third-party cookies. Another thing they might do, a stronger version of this that you can enable in some browsers is you can just say, don't accept cookies in this case at all. Like just ignore cookies from bar.com. But whatever rules you have set up to deal with this scenario, you know, which could be like any level of strictness, you know, they don't get obeyed in this type of case. So browsers that have been concerned about tracking have kind of had to implement mitigations for this. And this means that, for example, Firefox, based on the top-level website, not only do they separate the cookies, they also separate the caches. So they say if we have these two images from bar.com on these two websites, they're going to be cached independently of each other because we need to prevent this type of tracking. We need to make it so bar.com can't learn about this association from how things are cached. And also, they have to isolate connections, because another thing that bar.com could do is that if we load these two web pages loaded at the same time, and the browser tries to not use extra connections, well, we might load these two images on two different connections, on the same connection, and that's obviously the same browser. And that apparently is an actual form of tracking that people have done, is deliberately setting up that situation to associate users. Okay, so questions about our super cookie scenario? So with these kind of restrictions on sort of third-party sharing and this idea that like the cookies are kind of per website, you might wonder, like, how do we handle a case where we kind of have deliberate communication with a third website? And the classic example is NetMatch, Right, how to NetBadge, right, you have this other website that's not the one you're logging into that somehow communicates your, this user. Yeah. And typically the way this works is we kind of take, is we have our client basically forward the messages from one website to another. So NetBadge is an example of what's called single sign-on, because you know, in theory, you only sign on once. In practice, I know that's not really what NetBadge does, but that's how it's supposed to work. And the idea is that if you go to foo.com, foo.com is going to have your browser kind of communicate between the single sign-on site and it for it, because it's not going to actually contact the single sign-on site directly. It's going to go through your browser. And how we do that is, well, we can first communicate the sign-on request by redirecting to a URL that encodes where we're logging into. And then when you go to that site, it can redirect you back to foo.com. And typically the way that would be done is we want that to be a post request, not a get request, because we don't want it to be repeated. So typically what we'll do is we'll have an HTML form that posts to foo.com be submitted. And that post will contain information from the SSO.com, and well, you know, you might say, well, if it does that, like, can't I just change that information to say, I'm logged in as professor instead of student? Well, what's going to prevent that is that information is going to have some cryptographic properties. You know, it's going to be encrypted or signed or something. So that's kind of the typical way that single sign-on systems, like, work on top of HTTP. And this pattern comes up a bunch of times. We basically are using the client, typically a web browser, to communicate between two different servers. Okay. So questions about that? Okay. So one other thing that HTTP can do, and is very often done, is proxies. And there's kind of two forms proxies takes, one of which is very rare these days, and one of which is very common these days. So we'll start with the very rare form, because it's the one that's most obvious to you as a user, that this is part of my Firefox settings, and I can configure proxy access to the internet. So what does that mean? And there's this option for an HTTP or HTTPS proxy. What does an HTTP or HTTPS proxy do? And how does that work with my web browser? And what's going to happen is my web browser, which the HTTP standards call a user agent. I'm going to use the term user agent here to refer to something like a web browser. And I'm going to refer to this server that we're contacting in the proxy situation as a proxy server. And the reason I'm using the term user agent is that our proxy server, as you can see here, is both a server and a client. So I need to disambiguate. User agent is our web browser type thing. Proxy server is both a server and a client. So the user agent's going to send a request to the proxy server, and the proxy server is going to forward that on to the web server, kind of taking the place of the user agent and talking to the ultimate end web server. And HTTP has a standard way of specifying these requests that are meant to be forwarded. And what that looks like is that we can actually put a full URL in the get or post or similar request. And then the proxy server will send this request in the usual format to example.com. And then receive the result, send the result back, and so on. Yeah?
How is this different than a VPN?
How is this different than a VPN?
I'm probably not being
so. So I guess I'm planning on talking about encapsulation later. And we can kind of consider that when we do this sort of encapsulation, we have a choice about what layer are we encapsulating at. And here, we're encapsulating at the application layer. right? What we're forwarding are these whole HTTP messages. And as we'll learn, when we're talking about VPNs, typically those are encapsulating at the network layer. What we're forwarding are IP packets. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and so I do intend to talk about encapsulation later in the semester, and we'll see that, yeah, this is a sneaky preview of that, but this is at a very different layer, and therefore gives us kind of very different properties. Does that answer your question? So you might say, why would I use a proxy? There are what I would consider good reasons for using a proxy. There's caching for multiple users. One thing we can do with a proxy is that if we have common requests to the same thing, we can have them all share a cache, and that might be, let us have more cache hits, like therefore better performance, especially if our proxy is like local to a company or something like that, than we would otherwise. This is also why, if you look at the specs for the cache control header, there's this option private, and that's meant to say, if there's a proxy that's shared, should it cache this or not? Private says no. There are proxy servers you can find which are like deliberately there for like filtering content. So if you want to filter what a web browser receives, this is a way you can do it. You can get in the middle and you see each HTTP request in a nice clean way. You can do something to change what those are. It's also like if you want to do logging, so you might deliberately do this. If you want to debug a web application, you might just deliberately go through a proxy so you have a full, complete record of everything it's doing, even if you're using a strange web browser or other client. So there are some examples why you might want to do this. But I mentioned that proxies, like, they're a well-supported idea in HTTP. They're not very common. I think a big reason why is that they were kind of invented when we didn't have much HTTPS, when we didn't have much encryption, and their interaction with encryption isn't great in that, obviously if the proxy's seeing encrypted stuff, like, we can't do this sort of thing. These good reasons to have a proxy, and if it's seeing the decrypted stuff, well, then, if everyone at our company uses this proxy, then this proxy server, and they log into their banks from work, well, the proxy server has all their banking details, which maybe isn't great. But there's another type of proxy which is still very common today. That's called a reverse proxy. So the proxies I've talked about so far, what are often called forward proxies, in that, they look like a normal client to the end server. But they look different to the beginning server. So there are other proxies where basically the idea is like that this thing is acting like a client, right? The user agent and the forward proxy together are acting like a normal client. We can have this other design where the proxy server and a backend server are acting like a collective server. And that's called a reverse proxy. So we'll have this one server that's actually backed by several HTTP servers. Our browser will make this request to this reverse proxy server, and it will actually convert that request to a different request to one of possibly several backend servers. And this is a relatively common way to run a big website. You might say, why would we do that? Well, the biggest advantage here is that there's several advantages. So one thing we can do is we can have multiple web servers appear as one web server. That we can like have /foo:xxx go to one server, /bar:xxx go to another, without running separate servers, without changing what URLs look like when we change this configuration between one and two servers. We can also do caching or filtering on behalf of these backend servers, and that's a very common idea. Is that, you know, we'll have this reverse proxy also do caching, because just like the forward proxy can, the reverse proxy can do caching to reduce the load on the backend servers. And also, we can use this design if maybe one backend server isn't enough. We can have our reverse proxy split the request between, like, you know, 10 of them or something like that. Questions about this reverse proxy idea? So that's on reverse proxy. So one other thing that the forward proxy support is they support tunneling. So you might see that you can make non-web requests through an HTTP proxy. You might say, how the heck does that work? Right, you just told me we receive an HTTP message, we got it out. The way that works is that there's this special method that some proxy support, not all of them, but some of them do, called connect. And you make your connect request, and then, need to have this new line. Formatting issue. And then you get a HTTP header, and then rather than like getting the contents there, you just have a direct connection. You just have a TCP connection that's forwarded to the other, to the destination, unchanged. So in this example, I connect to ns.foo.com port 53, and once I do that, I can just send and receive stuff to the proxy server, and the proxy server is just forwarding it byte by byte back and forth. So that's, yeah. So that explains, like, how do people, you know, why are people talking about using HTTP proxies for, like, IRC? Like, how could that possibly work? And this is the answer. I don't think it's especially interesting, but, you know, if I don't mention it, it's going to be very confusing when you look up what people use proxies for. Okay, so we mentioned this reverse proxy idea, and I should have zoomed in on this. We can see one example of this in how Wikipedia's website works. So they have their internet stuff, then they have this, then it goes through this load balancer, then to this machine that terminates the encryption part of the connection. Then they have this front-end cache and this back-end cache, and then another load balancer, and most of these are reverse proxies. Not all of them, but many of these are reverse proxies. So like there's this sort of steps, and in a lot of the cases, the way these steps are implemented is we have a server that receives HTTP requests and sends out new HTTP requests. Not always, but that's how a lot of the steps are implemented. And this is a very common thing for large website configurations, for how their backend will actually work. So one other thing I'd like to talk about HTTP is that we talked about like sending, you know, other things through HTTP, but commonly you'll hear about people using HTTP to like give you access to some, you know, programmatic interface, or HTTP APIs. And probably the most common way those work, not the only way, is this idea called REST, or representational state transfer. And this is basically a pattern that you'll see all over the place for providing access to some service via HTTP. And the pattern part is that you have to map the operations you can do with the service to HTTP requests and responses. And so what the REST idea says is that we're going to represent entities in the system, and I'll give a specific example on the next slide, with URLs. When you want to get the state of an entity, you make a GET request. If you want to update the entity, you make a PUT or POST request. If you want to remove the entity, you make a DELETE request. And as an example, and Canvas has an API for programmatically accessing most of its stuff. And I'll give the example of how you can programmatically access announcements. So we're going to make HTTP requests. Now, Canvas, you know, doesn't just let anyone access anything. And so the solution they use for that is that our HTTP requests are going to have this authorization header where we're going to get a code from Canvas that you can set up. According to instructions they have, you can log in, click a few buttons, and get this secret code that you put in all your requests to indicate that, yes, it's from me who has access to this course's stuff. And so we make a request for a URL with that. And we can have our GET request to represent an entity. So in this case, we're getting course 123456's discussion topics. And we also specify this query parameter to only include announcements. And what we get back, in the case of Canvas, is going to be a JSON document that's a list of the announcements. Like, it's probably not really stored that way. It's probably stored in some sort of database structure, but they've converted it to this JSON format for us to use. And we can also use the same API to make a new announcement. And the way that works is, you know, for making a new object, typically that will map to a POST request. So in this case, I make a POST request to discussion topics, and I send the JSON for my new POST request. And I get back a response that gives me a copy of the JSON it interpreted for that document, which notably includes some new information for me. It includes the ID number it assigned so I can access it later. And if I want to update that entity, now that I have a specific ID, I can make this PUT request to that, you know, the specific URL for that entity, and, you know, send an update to it. And usually the way this will work is that I don't actually have to specify all the fields, but whatever fields I do specify will be update the data. Yeah. And again, it will probably give me back a copy of, you know, what it changed to for me to have. And so this basic idea for an API design, like, this is probably, if you see some website saying, we have an API, most commonly this kind of API is what they mean. And you can see how it maps to, you know, kind of relatively naturally HTTP and explains to us what are the put and delete methods for. Right, here's a good answer for that. So questions on our REST representational state transfer example. Yeah?
So, like, how would the, API calls be different if it's RESTless?
How would the API calls be different if it's not REST?
Yeah.
There are lots of different choices, and POST is new entity, choices you might see made. So one is that sometimes a common non-REST API that sometimes is done over HTTP is doing is remote procedure calls. So rather than sort of getting values of entities, you'll basically call functions on the server like that. So that would be another example of a very different common interface. otherwise, like, people just do ad hoc things. Like, so there's a lot of variety. But, like, the most common, like, standardized is remote procedure call schemes. So, like, SOAP is one of these, which has this, you know, a different model where you're calling operations on the server and providing arguments to them, essentially. Other questions? Okay, so let's move on to talking about our next big topic, which is going to be about multi-access media. So at the beginning of the semester, we mentioned that, you know, we can send things over these point-to-point links, which is what we spent most of the semester dealing with, or we can have things like radio or shared wires. And we're going to finally talk about, well, how do we make radio and shared wires work? Shared wires, like mentioned at the beginning of the semester, this used to be how Ethernet works. So Ethernet these days is almost always uses switches, which means that we only have, you know, each wire is only used to transmit messages from one node. Because Ethernet's a bundle of wires, so we each actually have separate wires for each direction. But this is how, for example, cable-based internet works. So cable-based internet, the cable lines that come into houses in an area typically are electrically bonded. And so everyone is getting all the same signals and sending signals that everyone else can get in that area. And so we need some way of sharing that. It's also typically how fiber to the home work. So typically in fiber to the home setups, we'll have separate fibers going into each home, but rather than having a relatively expensive active switch connected to that, we'll have a passive optical splitter. So we'll have some chip that like finally divides up the light between multiple channels and sends them out on multiple fibers without doing any processing, just like basically a funny mirror in a funny package. You know, a half silver mirror in a funny package. And so in these cases, we need to share this one medium between people. And also, we of course have the sort of air-based mediums, like radio is going to be our most notable case. In any of these cases, we can have multiple channels over a single medium, and we do. So there's going to be multiple channels, and these are things that we can separate in some way, you know, electrically or optically from each other. So we'll have radio or electrical signal frequencies or light frequencies. So we don't need to worry about like confusing transmissions on one channel from another. They kind of naturally separate. This is indeed something we'll take advantage of, but we're going to spend most of our time talking about, well, how do we coordinate a single channel? Because we're not going to have the luxury of giving everyone their own channel. So like on modern uses of Wi-Fi, there are like, you know, in the 2.4 gigahertz range, there are like three usable channels. You know, we can't just split them up among the 100 devices connected to a Wi-Fi network. And we're going to talk mostly about wireless. And one of the things that really shows up in how wireless is used is that radio spectrum is licensed. So there's specific rights to, you know, specific sets of frequencies. And a lot of computer networking has been very influenced by this. And the way it's been influenced by this is by using unlicensed bands, because it's a lot harder to get, more expensive to use licensed bands. So they use unlicensed bands, which this kind of affects our set of bands that we're going to use. But for cellular and stuff, they'll use these licensed bands because someone is getting, you know, specific permission for them. The unlicensed bands, even though they're unlicensed, this doesn't mean we can just do whatever we want with them. There are still legal restrictions on them. limits on power. Sometimes there's specific things you have to do to avoid interfering with other people. So for example, there's some frequencies that require dynamic frequency selection, meaning you need to check for interference before you use it, or you're not in compliance with the law. But to give an example, here are some selected unlicensed bands, and I cut off a few. So there's also 24 gigahertz and 60 gigahertz that got cut off this time. So there's these relatively little unlicensed bands. And some of these are unlicensed for like other reasons. So for example, 2.4 gigahertz, which is where a lot of computer networking stuff happens, is the frequencies microwave ovens use. It's not licensed because it gets absorbed by water. So it's not especially useful for radio transmissions, but we use it all the time now. And microwave ovens are going to interfere with it all the time. And like part of the 5 gigahertz band like is also useful for weather radar, for example. And that might be a reason why it was not really licensed for radio communication initially. And there's some of these other frequencies. And the generally, kind of the higher frequencies tend to be shorter range, higher bandwidth than the lower ones, but not always. But as I said, we're going to sort of worry about coordinating one channel. So we'll assume we've chosen a frequency, we're using it. What's going to happen when we have a bunch of nodes try to use all of that? And the big issue we have is what we call collisions. That if we have n nodes trying to transmit on this shared medium, be that a shared wire or a shared radio channel or a shared fiber, then the receiver is going to get garbage. And we call this scenario a collision. And I'm going to go through an example of thinking about coordinating for a collision. And we're going to first think about, how bad is this if we just let collisions happen and we do retransmission at some point when we don't get an ACK. So that's how we're going to recover from the collisions. And I'm going to base sort of an analysis I'm going to go through on some of the seminal works in this area, which is this paper on the Aloha system. And you might say, Aloha, that's an interesting name. And the Aloha system is named because it was developed at the University of Hawaii. They had this problem that they had campuses that were rather far apart and disconnected by water. So they did some of the very early important work on packet radio between those very separated campuses. So that's sort of much of the foundation of how Wi-Fi and even Ethernet works. They have this kind of necessity to solve that problem because, undersea cables are very expensive. And for my running example, I'm going to assume we have a bunch of nodes, A1 through N, all trying to transmit to B. And just to have some numbers, I'm going to assume that we want to send that's going to take a millisecond to send each message, and we want to send overall k messages per second across all these A nodes. And we're going to see what can we actually achieve if we try this. So questions about my scenario? Okay, now I'm going to go through some probability analysis. This is not a full math course, so we're not going to expect you to reproduce this, but it's going to be useful to look at the results we have here, figure it out. And we're going to assume for our sort of mathematical analysis that our model for when packets are sent is that it's going to follow an exponential distribution. If you remember taking your probability class, and did take a probability class, you might know that an exponential distribution is so-called memoryless, meaning that if we say that we have an exponential distribution with a mean of 1 second, that means that the expected time is 1 second, no matter what happened before. So it's memoryless, meaning that if we look at, say, at any time, what's my best guess for how long it's going to be? Well, if the mean is 1 second for an exponential distribution, it's always one. It doesn't matter if it just happened or it last happened an hour ago. It's the same. So that's the main property of an exponential distribution. And you might say, that's not realistic. You're right, it's not. But it's not clear like which direction we should go. Should things be less likely if they just happened? Should they be more likely if they haven't happened for a while? It's not actually clear which is best. So I think it's a reasonable sort of approximation. And the Aloha people observed that this analysis actually gave them results very close to what they were experiencing on their real network. So it had that sort of real world validation there. So a result from probability is that if this is the interval between sending packets, then we want to figure out what's the chance that we are sending packets too close to each other, right? The scenario we want to avoid is we have A1 sending a packet and A2 sending a packet, and oops, we have a collision. That's the scenario we want to avoid. So we want to figure out, what's the chance that after I decide to start sending it, that someone else decides to start sending in the middle. And the way the exponential distribution works is that we can compute the probability that the events occur less than k units apart using this formula here. And that's just... So we want to say, okay, we want to get them k units apart where, again, this lambda equals sort of the rate at which packets are generated, but remember they're not like evenly spaced, because that's not realistic, right? If we're sending 10 packets a second, that doesn't mean we send one packet and then send another packet 100 milliseconds later. We send some amount of time that averages to 100 milliseconds later, but it's going to vary, especially since we have all these different nodes not coordinated. And this k is the sort of time limit before next packet start. Okay, so we want to figure out basically how likely is it that we're going to have a long enough quiet period to not have a collision, right? How often is that true? That's going to be the central part of our analysis. And to think about that, we need to think about how long does the quiet time really need to be. And if I start sending a packet at this time here, in order not to have a collision, I can't have a packet start before it and too close to before it, right? So I have this time period before it during which no packet is allowed to start, or else we have a collision. And I also have a time period after it starts during which no packet can start, or I have a collision. So I actually need a quiet period of twice the packet transmission time in order not to have collisions. Like, not quite twice, because you might observe, this is going to be, if this is 1 millisecond here, this is a teeny bit less, this is also 1 millisecond here, but, that's where I get that twice, right? Twice exactly. But it's actually if it's exactly a millisecond, we're actually fine. But if it's anything a little bit less than a millisecond, we're going to have a collision. Right, so effectively, we need to have this 2 millisecond quiet period. And this might intuitively tell you that, gosh, we aren't going to get very good utilization, that we're going to be wasting a lot of time given this. And that's, you know, going to give us this intuitive, this result, where it's going to turn out that we're not going to even be able to use, we're not going to be able to fully utilize our channel. You know, just inherently with how this works. So, our chance to avoid collisions if we apply our exponential distribution formula with a 1 millisecond packet, we need a 2 millisecond interval around it. This gives us our, that if we have k packets a second, this gives the chance is going to be this formula here, 1 minus e to the negative 2 over 1,000. So this is kind of like basically the, you know, portion of the amount of time, you know, the length in seconds of the quiet period times the rate per number of packets per second. That's our formula. And to give actual numbers, we can plot that. So the chance of collisions per message, as the number of messages increases, we can see it kind of goes up. You know, the more messages we have, which is pretty intuitive. And like when we have 500 messages a second, we have about a 60% chance that each of them is going to have a collision. But I'm missing a big important factor here, which is that I'm kind of assuming that when we have a collision, we just forget about the message. But that's not what we're going to do, right? We're going to resend it if we want reliable transmission, and we usually do. So we're not going to send k messages per second. We're going to send some r that's much bigger than k, with given how many collisions we have. And we can actually figure out kind of in our model how that will be by saying that, well, our number of collisions are percent collisions times the number of things transmitted plus the number of original transmissions. It's going to be the number of things transmitted, right? We have basically, if we know we're retransmitting everything that collides, we can compute the number is the original number plus the number of retransmissions is the total number of transmissions r. And this is like, so this here is the number of retransmissions, and this is the original transmissions, and this is the total. So we can compute that, so we can solve that for k, for the transmission rate, and we can get this plot saying if we generate packets at a certain rate, what is our effective usage of the network? So this is the rate on channel. You know, the effective rate we get after accounting for retransmissions. And we have this asymptotic behavior here. So one thing we see is that kind of our maximum is going to be that we get half the channel utilized, and after this point, you know, this is going to, you know, sort of the, we get instability above this point. It just doesn't work. We end up having too many retransmissions, we fall behind, we never actually manage to achieve it. So the maximum rate of transmissions we can achieve is generating around this 180-ish packets per second, even though if only one person was sending stuff on this radio frequency, we could send 1,000 per second. And this is because those retransmissions kind of explode as our collision probability gets high enough. So at our kind of maximum, we're using half the capacity of the channel. Right, we have about 500 packets sent per second. If we send any more, like to things just, we just have too many retransmissions to keep up, just fall behind. And we're using about a sixth of the capacity. In particular, 1/2 e of the capacity. Okay, so questions about this result here? So this, you know, this tells us like sort of what we can get away with on a shared channel if we do kind of the naive thing. But these results are pretty disappointing. It's pretty disappointing that we can basically lose 5/6 of our bandwidth due to having multiple users. And our real achievable bandwidth, you know, is so small compared to how much the medium is actually capable of. And, you know, we're talking about things like Wi-Fi, we're kind of using this very precious, you know, unlicensed spectrum that there's not much of. We want to, like, fully utilize that. So we're going to want to improve on this. And there's going to be several options we'll have for that. The first one I'll talk about is carrier sense. Then a big problem I had here is that if I look at happening here, that, you know, probably here I can say, maybe I could notice that I probably shouldn't start transmitting there, right? I could tell that if I was listening to the channel. And similarly here, maybe I could tell that I shouldn't start transmitting yet if I was listening to the channel. So one idea we'll have is this idea of carrier sense. That we can check whether the channel is busy or not. So before we start transmitting, and this should substantially lower our number of collisions. And we can see that based on what happens when we don't do this, you know, this is probably a really good idea for efficiency. So there's a problem here, which is, well, okay, so we've detected that the channel is busy. When do we transmit if it's busy now? And there's some options, right? So one option is we could just not. That's probably not acceptable in practice. The simplest option is we could transmit right away after it gets busy. But there's a problem here, which is that if we aren't the only one doing that, well, that's not going to work. Right? If two nodes are both saying, oh, can't transmit now, there'd be a collision, and they follow this second policy, they're going to have a problem the second time. Right? They're going to collide that time, and carrier sense won't help them because, well, immediately says we don't do carrier sense. But let's say we did. Let's say we did it after they stopped, transmission stopped, and then we checked for a sec, you know, a microsecond to make sure no one was still transmitting. Great. Well, now we're perfectly in sync. We're going to collide. And this is also a problem with kind of the naive version of the sometime after it's busy. You might say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to wait 100 microseconds just in case. Well, if we both wait 100 microseconds, we're going to collide again. So what we want to do, so a goal we're going to have is kind of desynchronizing sort of multiple retransmitters or delayed transmitters. right? We don't want them to stay precisely in sync and transmit at exactly the same time. So questions? So one idea is that we can kind of divide up, if all our packets are roughly the same size, an idea we can use for this is we can divide up time into these slots. And we can say that what I'm going to do is after the transmission, I'm going to choose to either transmit in slot 1, slot 2, slot 3. And if I'm worried about multiple transmitters, I can choose which one I transmit in kind of at random to hopefully I'll choose a different random number enough of the time to usually not collide. And I'll just choose which of these slots. And the reason why we do these discrete slots is that if everyone's transmitting packets of the same length, then I know that if I choose slot 2, then that should be immediately after someone who chose slot 1. And we don't have to worry about like that, you know, half overlap thing if everyone's choosing the same size. If they aren't, well, this doesn't work so well. So in this sort of slotted design, we'll look at the end of the transmission and we'll just choose a slot we'll transmit in, possibly the first one, possibly some later one. And this is in a scheme that 802.11b, one of the early versions of Wi-Fi, did. So they have these 20 microsecond slots and some interframe spacing, some time after a transmission used to make sure ACKs get received and so on. And the policy they use is that they guess, first of all, that there's only one node that is waiting, that they're waiting for, that the network's quiet. So the first time they wait long enough for after the transmission for there to be an ACK. So something that Wi-Fi does that we'll see why it does it later is that to make sure your packet was received, you receive an immediate ACK from the receiver. So there's some time, quiet time here we have to receive that ACK. So 802.11b's policy is we transmit after the ACK has been received, should have been received if there was one, the first time. If we get a collision, if we don't get an ACK the first time, then we retransmit in one of these slots and we choose basically one of the between 0 and 32. We choose a slot number at random, and the goal here is that if like 5 people are all trying to use the Wi-Fi, we're likely to choose different slots, we won't interfere. If that still doesn't work, we increase that from 32 to 64, and 64 to 128, and so on. And the idea here is that because we're choosing different transmission times, you know, we're likely not to interfere. And we increase the time because, you know, if we interfere the first time and the second time, probably there's too many people for us to, you know, be spreading out the transmissions enough. So you want to spread them out more and more. And this idea is pretty common. So this is binary exponential backoff. And that's the big thing that, you know, that's what we see done in probably most of these multi-access protocols is we do some form of this for retransmissions, where we want to sort of increase our delay to like this randomized delay to hopefully have a time when eventually we don't collide because we spread things out enough and we haven't chosen the same random numbers like 10 times in a row. So that's where I'll pick up next time. And next time we'll talk about sort of a bit about collision detection, and then we'll talk about some problems that are specific to wireless. That is, and among other things, why the idea of collision detection, which is what Ethernet uses, doesn't work on wireless.